Geography. Free space for geography. Extending teaching and learning methods beyond the boundaries of campus.
Did you hear about Frontline?
Well, Frontline is camping
with Frontline.
Frontline, by the way, has outstanding productions.
Geography Frontline.
Hello, everybody, long-time listeners, new listeners, frontliners around the world. How are you today? It's been an interesting week since the launch of the first English episode of Geography Frontline. Subscribers of the podcast begin to rise again after 4 months without Frontline. Yeah, followers on Facebook jump about 3% in just 1 week. That's amazing. There's quite a bit of feedback on the topics of last week's show, and yeah, could always be more, of course, but it's a fair start. So let's hear what we'll talk about today. We'll talk about recaps on bikeway design and solar power. Last episode, we've talked about a new bikeway design guide that was released just 2 weeks ago. It's about setting up a frame for US cities to structure or restructure their traffic, with a special focus on integrating bikeways into it. We've spoken about this 200 plus pages guidelines that all seem to be pretty basic and simple. And I ask you to state your opinion on the topic in a quick vote. Yeah, for those who are new to Geography Frontline, the quick vote is the easiest way to leave instant feedback on one of the show's topics. If you go to our website, geography.com, and there go to the Frontline subpage, and there go to the latest episode, you'll find a drop-down menu on that page where you can just click on one of the answers. And last week's question of the quick vote was a new design guide for bikeways. And 50% of the voters decided to click answer A, essential for urban planning. Yeah, that this new design guide for bikeways is essential for urban planning. And another 50% chose answer C, that it won't have a positive effect. Nobody of the people voting thought that this design guide for bikeways might be B, a really good idea, or D, a waste of taxpayers' money. Interesting, yeah. And Michi from Augsburg left a comment in the comment section of the quick vote. That's a really great option if you want to specify your voting or have another opinion. So he wrote, everywhere necessary. I'm not sure if it's everywhere necessary. There's a good network of bikeways in a lot of cities in Germany. My home city, Augsburg, for example, has a pretty good network of bikeways and does not really need a design guide. Hey Michi, just a quick question. Are you sure that there isn't already a German bikeway design guide in place? Perhaps the one that made your city's solution so good? Just a thought, yeah? Just a thought. He goes on. On the one hand, if there was such a guide, then probably everything would have to be reconverted or modified as specified. Finally, it must all be strictly in Germany according to the DIN standard. That means we need money that we do not have and building sites which no one wants any more of. On the other hand, many cities are very poorly equipped with bikeways and could need quite a bit of pressure. Last but not least, cycling is still environmentally more friendly than driving a car. And if the possibility is given, then we'll ride a bike more often. Yeah, okay. I think that's what you mean. So, what do you think about that? He's asking us. Greets from Augsburg, Michi. Okay. That is one statement, right? If the possibility is given, meaning if a city would have an excellent bikeway system where it's safe and fun to drive, the urban dweller would get rid of her or his car and ride the bike. Did I get that right, Michi? To be honest, I'm not so sure about that. But instead of giving you my opinion, let's ask our frontliners what they think. So to give all of you more content about bikeways, that it might be easier to form an opinion about that topic, here's what I've read the last week on the web. There's a new sign of fall in Toronto. The removal of bike lanes. The removal? Wow. That sounds interesting. In that context of a new design guide in the US. At the beginning of the month, we took note of a deinstallation of bike lanes. Opponents of the lanes will likely argue that with their removal, there is enough space to accommodate an additional lane for vehicles in both directions. Yeah, and on that webpage, there's a really nice comment on the from BJ, who says, who cares? It's Scarborough. That's a part of Toronto, I guess. Where nobody walks or rides a bike anyway. Huh? If you spent time living in this area, you'd know that these bike lanes get used maybe once a week. There you have it. Get rid of the bike lanes. Nobody wants to ride a bike. At least not in Toronto, you know. And then I read on MSNBC that there might be something behind the use or non-use of these bike lanes. Huh? Here, I'm reading from the webpage of MSNBC. Several factors make a city easy to live in without a car. The most important one is a widely available and efficient public transportation system. Another is having daily amenities, such as groceries, shopping, schools, and entertainment nearby and within easy reach on foot or by bicycling. Amenities within easy reach on foot or by bicycling. That makes sense, right? And on the website it goes on, for people without cars, large cities with dense populations can be easier to handle if they have exceptional levels of walkability. Meaning, Toronto, at least the area where they remove the bike lanes, might just not be so walkable. And speaking of walkability, a great source to test your own home's walkability is walkscore.com. That's a really great website. And we've already talked about that page in one of the episodes of Geography Frontline. Don't remember exactly which episode that was. But okay, let's do a little contest here. We need some kind of a jingle for that. Yeah, contest. Walkability contest. Who got the highest walk score for her or his home? Go to walkscore.com. Do it right now. Okay, unless you're on a bike or running or someplace else where you can't access the web. But yeah, go to walkscore.com, type in your address, home address, and send me the results to comment@geography.com. Okay, to kick in, the first number to beat, my home in Austin, gets a somewhat walkable 65 out of 100. That's not bad. Yeah. But what about your home? The frontliner with the highest score wins. So send it to me right away. Come on. And there's another aspect that is important for our discussion. And that is affordability. The news agency Interpress Service writes, eco-mobility gaining ground step by step. Berlin, Paris, Tokyo, Seoul, Bogota, New York City, and other major cities simply cannot afford the cost, the pollution, the noise, and the congestion of more cars. They are embracing a new concept called eco-mobility, mobility without private cars. So, do we have to widen our view on the topic and say it's not only about bikes, it's about managing the whole city? Let's read on. Eco-mobility is not only walking, cycling, and public transportation. It's about these three systems clicking together. Connectivity is the key, says Gil Peñalosa, former director of Parks and Recreation in Bogota, Colombia. Okay, let's summarize. Bikeways in cities. This seems to be quite a geographical topic. And not only for those who like to see greener cities around the globe. In some way, it might be necessary to master today's problems like traffic and pollution in high-density areas. But without a proper grid of amenities, this will make no sense and be no solution for the people living in those areas, right? The discussion about bikeways, I think that seems to lead us directly into urban planning and the structure of a city. So what about all those topics, huh? Urban planning, structure of the city, are they addressed right now? Do we just get a new bikeway design guide to ease our concerns? Can we find something about that topics in the news, restructuring the urban environment and so on? This is a call out to all of you Really, read the news, surf the web, and try to find something that deals with those questions. If you find an interesting article, send it to me and let me know what you think of it. Write to comment@geography.com or talk to the Skype voicemail of Geography Frontline. Skype name is Geography. Pretty easy to remember, right? And for all of you, of course, I'm sure that you have some opinion on the topic, make your click on this week's quick vote. The question of this week's quick vote is new bikeways in the city. Answer A. That makes sense on its own. Answer B. That calls for walkable amenities. Or decide to click on answer C. New bikeways in a city is part of a citywide reorganization. Or perhaps you decide to click on D if you have another opinion. I'm curious how the Frontline community will decide. And don't forget to send me the walkable score of your home. Hey, this song has such long credits that'll probably be over by the time I've read them all to you. It fits great to the bikeway topic. So these are Tam Tam and the Sandwich Man and the Magical Sugar Cookies. That's the name of the band. With their song Zen and the Art of Bicycle Maintenance from the album They Grow Meat. You can find the song on the Podsafe Music Network on music.mevio.com.
Life is like riding a bike against the wind. The more you push, the more you push, the more the world gives in. You never notice this inside of your cars. You never notice anything inside of your cars. You never notice anything. You never notice.
That is Zen and the Art of Bicycle Maintenance from Tam Tam and the Sandwich Man and the Magical Sugar Cookies from the album They Grow Meat. You can find that on the Podsafe Music Network on music.mevio.com. The links to both the iTunes store album download and the German one, I stick them in through the show notes, and then you can just click on it and buy the song or the whole album if you like.
What's that sound?
Last week I played you a small sound sample. You had to guess and make Make up your mind what makes such a sound. Okay, listen to the sound of last week's episode. And frontliners, was it too hard to guess? Is our auditive awareness so broke that no one could guess it? Yeah? Or did you simply didn't find the time to call in because no one took a guess? Hey, that's sad. Do you really don't know what this is? Well, instead of giving you a new sound sample, let's just stick with this one for another episode. And so, the question again is to raise our auditive awareness in our environment. What's that sound? Send your guesses to comment@geography.com or leave your statement on the voicemail. And it's time again for a quick look at our Facebook page. We are closing in to having 400 frontliners on Facebook, a number that should never stop rising. If you haven't already checked out the site, go to facebook.com/geography and you'll find a rising number of frontliners that share their thoughts on topics relevant from a geographical point of view. You can not only post links, but also share photos, audio files, and even video. So go ahead and take a look, comment on other posts, and follow Frontline on Facebook. Yeah, like Stefan. He posted a great link on a website from The Telegraph. Title is BBC to Open Vast Radio Archive Online. The BBC is to introduce a new radio website codenamed Audiopedia. Yeah, that's a really cool name, yeah. To contain virtually its entire archive of speech radio programs going back to the 1940s. The service is being developed for launch within the next 12 months. Isn't that great? The BBC gets some awesome productions. Yeah, yeah. And I can't wait to search all that content. Well, that's amazing. Let's keep each other posted about the launch of that service. You don't really want to miss on this. What else do we have on Frontline on Facebook? Let me just scroll through the posts. Oh, right. Yeah, I uploaded a short video myself where you can take a look at my pretty face in front of my MacBook's camera. Nice. Yeah, there are some comments on how people like the new language the show is produced in. And as I said, feel free to add your comments and post interesting stuff yourself. Do you remember DesertTech? DesertTech, the joint venture of many global players from energy to finance that are currently trying to set up a huge solar power grid in the Sahara Desert. We've talked about the initial plans and even had an interview with one leading character of the DesertTech Foundation here in the show. Yeah, I think it was in the 70s, must have been in the 70s of Geography Frontline. In case you missed it, here's a short recap. So what is the DesertTech Foundation? I'm reading from their website. The DesertTech Foundation is a global civil society initiative aiming to shape a sustainable future. It was established on January 20th, 2009 as a non-profit foundation that grew out of the network of scientists, politicians and economists from around the Mediterranean who developed the DesertTech concept. Founding members of DesertTech Foundation are the German Association of the Club of Rome, members of the international network, as well as committed private individuals. Yeah, you can read all about DesertTech Foundation in the links I put together in the show notes. Just click on that and read for yourselves. The companies who are behind DesertTech are part of the DII, and that's the DesertTech Industrial Initiative. Leading the way, Siemens, Deutsche Bank, this huge German bank, MAN, Solar Millennium, solar company, Schott Solar, another solar company, HSH Nordbank, another bank, Munich Re, that's an insurance company, very huge one, and so on. All European global players that invest in the DesertTech idea. All in all, I think around 20 founding members and some more that joined them later on after 2009. So the concept behind DesertTech is quite simple. DesertTech demonstrates a way to provide climate protection energy security and development by generating sustainable power from the sites where renewable sources of energy are at their most abundant. So DesertTech goes into the Sahara Desert, builds huge solar power plants, and ships the energy to Europe. Boom. That's the simple, simple, simple version. The reason why I bring up this topic again is an article from The Guardian titled "Morocco to host first solar farm in 400 billion euro renewables network." Whoa, not too shabby. Morocco, yeah. "The vast solar and wind farm project across North Africa and the Middle East may provide 15% of Europe's electricity by 2050. Sounds great, right? Yeah. How lucky can the Moroccans be to be the chosen ones for that project? Hey, 12 square kilometers for a 500 megawatts solar farm near the desert city of Ouarzazate. Wow! And how will the locals benefit from these projects? That's always an interesting question. And on the website, they say the conference was told via a DII promotional video that the network of solar and wind farms across the MENA, that's the Middle East, Northern Africa, MENA region, would help to halt migration into Europe. Oh yeah, halt migration into Europe by fast-tracking the rise of the region's youthful population out of poverty and unemployment. Oh yeah, that is so great. The last time I checked, Ouarzazate, a city, by the way, I've visited about 15 years ago or so, was a really popular tourist location. Mm-hmm. Not only for trips into the sand desert and the beautiful oasis and the Dra region, but for its film industry, with locations like Eid Ben Haddou, if you're familiar with this city. It's not so correct to call it a city. Okay, but anyways, movies like Gladiator, Lawrence of Arabia, Kingdom of Heaven, and many more were shot there. And said, so now the youthful population will rise out of poverty and unemployment. Of course, we all know down there in Morocco, there's nothing going on, right? Yeah, poor people, and we have to help them. This is great. Okay, when I hear such good news, I'm always a bit suspicious. What can you do to find out more about such news topics that circulate in the media? Well, thanks to the internet, you can always find a ton of background information about everything. Like this 21-page PDF file from the African Development Bank Group that talks about the Ouarzazate Solar Power Station project. The date is October 2011, so pretty up to date. Let's ask some questions from a geographical point of view and see if we can find some answers here, okay? Okay, if you want to read the whole document, there's also a link in the show notes. I would first go ask, are there local investors and local projects in the Sahara Desert? I don't think so, because in the file I'm reading, it says the project will be implemented through bid invitation from developers. Bid invitation, yeah? A project company will then be set up. Okay, not very likely Moroccan investors, if you have players like Siemens and Deutsche Bank at the table, if you ask me. But could this be a brownfield investment? You know the term, right? Brownfield investments, where local companies are part of the development process. I read, the industry fabric of the Ouarzazate province is inadequate to support local development. But if the young people of the region should get the chance to rise out of poverty and unemployment, as the article from The Guardian implicates, how does the local labor market and unemployment rates look like? The PDF file states employment is particularly high among the youth. Hey, they already have jobs, but perhaps they could find better labor. If they are qualified for it. Okay, the Gazat Council area, that's the council where they, near Ouarzazate, I suppose, where they should set up that power plant, that area has a rural population, yeah? Listen very closely, which engages in economic activities in the stock breeding agriculture, handicraft and trade sectors, extensive rearing of sheep and goats, and cattle fattening are most frequent. Okay, I'm a little confused now. Investors will most likely not come from the region. So won't construction companies and labor. But the PDF file also states that the project, I'm citing again, will generate 2,000 to 2,500 direct jobs and 10,000 indirect jobs. And these indirect jobs mainly relate to an increase in the activities of existing local enterprises. For the supply of materials and equipment needed for the activities and daily maintenance of workers. Okay, apart from that, that the region only inhabits 8,400 people. What kind of supplies should this 10,000 indirect jobs bring to the workers? These people are rearing sheep and goats. So frontliners, do you really think that the countries that give away their land for the project will benefit from it? I'd really like to hear your opinion on that. So feel free to drop me an email or send your voicemail comments. I'm just saying. Time to listen to a second song. This is the Five Jacks from the album Topanga Days with their song Morocco.
I'm walking around alone in a crowd. It's 110 and they're talking again.
Five Jacks with their song Morocco from the album Topanga Days. From the Podsafe Music Network, you find that on music.mevio.com. Both links to the iTunes store and to the German store are in the show notes. if you've listened to last week's episode, you'll know this jingle. This section of the show is called Humboldt's Voyage, and it's about Alexander von Humboldt's voyage to the Americas in 1800, around 1800. I'm reading from the free available book, and we try to find out what this might tell us for our today's research. Yeah. I think it's also a great source for getting inspired about going on field trips and excursions, doing empirical field work, and just loving geography. So last time, Alexander von Humboldt was to depart from France to Africa, but already had the feeling that he might not make it there, but leave for someplace else. Okay, let's see. The Swedish frigate, which was to convey Mr. Skoljebrand to Algiers, was expected at Marseille towards the end of October. Several times a day, we climbed the mountain of Notre Dame de la Garde, which commands an extensive view over the Mediterranean. Every sail we described in the horizon excited us in the most eager emotion. But after 2 months of anxiety and vain expectation, we learned by the public papers that the Swedish frigate, which was to convey us, had suffered greatly in a storm on the coast of Portugal and had been forced to enter the port of Cadiz to refit. We still persisted in the intention of visiting the African coast and were nearly becoming the victims of our perseverance. A small vessel of Ragusa, on the point of setting sail for Tunis, was at the time in the port of Marseille, and we thought the opportunity favorable for reaching Egypt and Syria, and we agreed with the captain for our passage. The vessel was to sail the following day, but a circumstance trivial in itself happily prevented our departure. The livestock intended to serve us for food during our passage was kept in the great cabin. We desired that some changes should be made which were indispensable for the safety of our instruments, and during this interval we learned at Marseille that the government of Tunis persecuted the French residing in Barbary, and that every person coming from a French port was thrown into a dungeon. Oops. Having escaped this imminent danger, we were compelled to suspend the execution of our projects, and we resolved to pass the winter in Spain. On my arrival at Madrid, I had reason to congratulate myself on the resolution I had formed of visiting the peninsula. Baron de Forel, minister from the court of Saxony, treated me with a degree of kindness of which I soon felt the value. He was well versed in mineralogy and was full of zeal for every undertaking that promoted the progress of knowledge. He observed to me that under the administration of an enlightened minister, Don Mariano Luis de Urquijo, I might hope to obtain permission to visit, at my own expense, the interior of Spanish America. After the disappointments I had suffered, I did not hesitate a moment to adopt this idea. I was presented at the court of Aranjuez in March 1799, and the king received me graciously. Hey, Alexander von Humboldt going to the king. Speaking to the king of Spain. Wow. So, to make a long story short, he goes on, we left Madrid about the middle of May, crossed a part of Old Castile, the kingdoms of Leon and Galicia, and reached Coruña, where we were to embark for Cuba. Wow. So, what's going on there? I'm skipping a few pages here to not to make this story too long. The first Secretary of State had recommended us very particularly to Brigadier Don Rafael Clavijo, who was employed in forming new dockyards at Coruña. He advised us to embark on board the sloop Pizarro. Señor Clavijo ordered the necessary arrangements to be made on board the sloop for placing our instruments, and the captain of the Pizarro received orders to stop at Tenerife as long as we would judge necessary to enable us to visit the port of Orotava and ascend the peak. Yeah, and what should I say? I think, let's read a little more, because then they embark. And there's a passage coming up that's, I think, is interesting for us, and we can learn something out of it. During this interval, we employed ourselves in preparing the plans we had collected in the beautiful valleys of Galicia, which no naturalist had yet visited. We examined the Fuki and the Mollusca, which the northwest winds had cast with great profusion on the foot of the steep rock on which the lighthouse of the Tower of Hercules is built. Mm-hmm. This edifice, also called the Iron Tower, was repaired in 1788, and it's 92 feet high, its walls are 4 feet and a half thick, and its construction clearly proves that it was built by the Romans. An inscription discovered near its foundation, a copy of which Mr. Lombard obligingly gave me, informs us that this pharos was constructed by Caius Sevius Lupus, architect of the city of Aqua Flavia, Chavez, and that it was dedicated to Mars. So, question, he's asking, why is the Iron Tower called in the country by the name of Hercules? Was it built by the Romans on the ruins of a Greek or Phoenician edifice? Strabo, indeed, affirms that Galicia, the country of the Kaleki, had been peopled by the Greek colonies. Okay, I'd like to take a break here and say to you, look at names of buildings, like Humboldt's doing, or names of settlements, names of fields, to draw conclusions. So why, for example, is the city of Corpus Christi called Corpus Christi? Because, you might know that it was a tradition when founding a new settlement, it was the tradition to name that settlement after the Catholic saint whose name day it was when the settlers arrived. So take a look at topographic maps and what kind of names you find there. That might lead you to some interesting conclusions when they have been founded, where. Now, where you see that, obviously, by looking at the map, but perhaps why. So these names are kind of important and help you to better understand the topographic maps, the environment in which you are in. And like Alexander von Humboldt, just wondering why this is called the Tower of Hercules. And this wondering, that you begin to wonder is the first step in gaining new knowledge. That's perfect. So I think after this Tenerife stop from Humboldt, when he's going on to embark for Cuba, we can see what happens then in the next episode of Geography Frontline. So, up come the announcements for this day's episode, and that's the International College of Territorial Sciences. And they got a conference going. They announced an international conference called Founding Territorial Sciences. It's going to take place November 23rd to 25th, so in just, 2 weeks or so? Yeah? In Paris, in France. A link to the website is in the show notes. And the topics range from defining territorial sciences to territorial information, mobilities, and identities and territories. Seems a lot of the presentations will be in French, but as it is an international conference and they do have an English version of their website, there should be some kind of translation going on. So, interestingly enough, if you want to, just fly... or ride your bike over to Paris for that international conference Founding Territorial Sciences taking place in Paris from November 23rd to 25th, 2011. So, this is it. Number 108 of Geography Frontline comes to an end. All links of today's episode can be found in the show notes. Just go to the website, Frontline 108, and check them out. Also, send me your feedback to topics like bikeway design, walk score, sound riddle, and everything else that might be of geographical interest for our community. Whatever you decide to do, never forget our common motto, the network is us.